Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, a lot of students preparing for college are concerned about being able to afford it, especially with problems that have plagued the federal financial aid process. We'll hear how some are trying to work through it. Could ranked choice voting become more widely adopted in Illinois? We'll discuss an effort. The Pritzker administration wants to get rid of the grocery tax, even though research has found it would only be a modest savings to households while causing financial shortfalls for local communities. We'll learn more. Illinois has also proposed more than doubling the tax on sports wagering. We'll find out more about the growing industry and also how additional gambling options have resulted in additional addictions and why those who raise sheep are rethinking their options as the cost of wool has continued to drop. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A report looking at the potential impact of eliminating Illinois' grocery tax finds most households would only see modest relief. Yet the Pritzker administration remains committed to the cut. Joe Deacon takes a closer look.
Governor J.B. Pritzker called for a permanent elimination of Illinois' 1% grocery tax during his State of the State speech in February, while announcing a $52.7 billion budget plan. Deputy Governor Andy Menar says the administration believes the grocery tax is regressive and the time has come to end it on the state level.
The governor has said the state should not be in the business of taxing groceries, especially when the state doesn't spend the money that is generated from the tax. So if it's a local decision to spend the money and how it's spent, then it should be a local decision as to whether or not it should be taxed.
All of the revenue from the grocery tax goes to local governments. When Pritzker suspended the grocery tax for 1 year in 2022, the state reimbursed municipalities for the lost revenue. But that wouldn't be the case under his new proposal. The Illinois Municipal League strongly opposes cutting the state grocery tax, estimating Pritzker's proposal would cost municipalities a total of $325 million annually. A recent policy spotlight published by the University of Illinois Systems Institute of Government and Public Affairs finds that while municipalities are projected to see significant lost revenue, individual households would only see modest savings. IGPA Interim Associate Director Elizabeth Powers is the report's author. She says the lowest income households that use SNAP benefits already pay no taxes on goods.
Now, as you move up the income distribution and fewer households get SNAP, then, of course, they are subject to the grocery tax. And you do see some regressivity of lower middle and middle income households relative to those higher income households.
The report says a family would need to spend at least $30,000 a year on groceries to see a few hundred bucks in savings. Peoria could lose around $4 million a year. Peoria Mayor Rita Ali says city leaders were blindsided by Pritzker's plan, and they will need to consider implementing a local grocery tax to recoup the lost revenue.
Because if we don't, we're going to lose very important services. I mean, $4 million is about 12% of our community development budget. We could lose protective services. We would definitely have to cut staff in important areas.
The Political Action Committee, BizPAC of Central Illinois, wants the Peoria City Council to support the governor's proposal and refrain from imposing new taxes by trimming $4 million in, quote, unnecessary expenses from the annual budget. Ali bristles at that suggestion.
I mean, that was an insult that we have $4 million in unnecessary expenses because we don't. The expenses that we have are those that are vital services to our community.
Since Pritzker announced the plan as part of his budget proposal, many expected it would go into effect on July 1st. Powers says that would present a big problem for municipalities.
Because the deadlines for them to substitute their own grocery tax have passed. And so if it were to be implemented July 1st, they would at least have missed out on a part year of the tax collections.
However, Andy Menar says no one from the administration ever said July 1st would be the implementation date. Menar says Pritzker spoke to the IML about flexibility with the implementation earlier this month on Lobby Day in Springfield.
He said he was open and has consistently said he is open to an implementation timeline that makes sense. There's all kinds of things that have to be taken into consideration, and the administration recognizes that. For example, when tax rates change, you just don't flip a switch.
Joe Deacon with that report. Elizabeth Powers says the worst alternative for towns to recoup the lost grocery tax revenue would be to raise other retail taxes. She says that would hit low-income individuals even harder. The general election is inching closer, but a task force of state officials and voting rights advocates are already thinking about how Illinoisans will vote in the future. One idea on the table is ranked choice voting. Mabwa Iqbal from our State House Bureau has been following this, and she spoke with Mary Dixon about how it could shape Illinois' elections going forward.
So how does ranked choice voting work?
Yeah, so basically you have multiple candidates and you rank them from your favorite to least favorite. So of course the people who get the lowest rankings are booted out, and the goal for the candidate is to get 51% of the majority vote.
Also, if you don't have a clear winner in a first round of voting, you do end up with runoff elections, right?
You do, yeah. So basically the people who are booted out in the first round, so the people with the lowest rankings, the voters who rank those people first, obviously that vote doesn't get counted, but then their second choices get counted. So whoever they rank second now gets their vote. And then they just keeps going and going and going until someone gets to 51%.
Where is ranked choice voting being used?
So currently it's being used in like 50 jurisdictions nationwide. So anywhere from like really small cities to even some states. Actually, there are two states that are using it now, Alaska and Maine. And as far as jurisdictions go, you know, you have some big cities like New York City and San Francisco. And then even in Evanston, they're planning on rolling it out in 2025.
And why are folks interested in seeing this implemented more widely in Illinois?
Proponents say that, you know, this will create more fair elections. They talk about how when there's only two candidates, it's really easy for the campaign strategy to be to attack the other candidate. You know, they have sort of a quote-unquote one clear enemy. But when you have multiple candidates and you're trying to appeal to multiple groups of voters to get the best rankings overall, they say the campaigns become more policy focused. It also, they argue voters feel more confident going to the polls. So they don't feel like they have to, you know, choose between the lesser of two evils. They can have a wider range of options.
And why are people opposed to implementing ranked choice voting?
There's two big arguments against it from the opponents. One is more of a technological one, and the other is more of an ideological one. So technological one is of course, you know, do we have the systems to count these ballots? A lot of election authorities, a lot of people who work for local election authorities have come to the Illinois task force to talk about how, you know, our systems aren't capable of counting these ballots. They also say that the ballot sheets themselves would be a lot longer, so that would cost more money to print out these longer sheets. And they talk about how voters can potentially become confused, you know, just with the new process, especially in the beginning. And so that'll take a longer time for them to vote at the polls, and so they'll have to hire more workers, and there'll be longer lines. And then they also talk about, you know, with this learning curve that they have to manage, is it really worth it? Like, are we really solving a problem here? Like if it isn't broke, you know, why fix it?
Mabwa Iqbal covers the Illinois State House for public radio stations, and she spoke with Mary Dixon. Imagine making one of the biggest purchases in your life and not knowing how much it's going to cost. Now imagine doing it when you're just 17 or 18 years old. This year, many high school seniors are being pressured to do just that. That's because the federal financial aid form known as FAFSA has been a hot mess. Lisa Curry and Phillip takes us to a college counselor's office to hear how it's all playing out.
Hey, sorry for the delay.
A senior walks into LaVon Robinson's windowless walk-in closet of an office. The student is just 3 weeks away from graduation.
So you got to take half of that? It's becoming real.
Yeah, it's becoming real. It's crazy.
I have to ask, what's the story with prom on Saturday?
There's so much to it. So
LaVon is a college counselor at Downers Grove South High School in the southwest suburbs. He starts every appointment with chit-chat about teenage life. But once they cover prom drama, he gets down to business.
So what's the college update?
I committed to ISU.
You did? So, that's exciting.
Yeah, I did. I'm very excited.
LaVon smiles and claps, then asks,
did you get your financial aid award letter?
I don't think so yet.
Oh.
The surprise in his voice. That's because financial aid award letters lay out how much help the student will get paying tuition and how much they'll have to pay out of pocket. So committing to a college without seeing it, that's like buying a house without knowing its price. And as far as LaVon knows, this student can't afford to do that.
Have you had conversations with your parents about costs?
That I actually wanted to ask you about. What is a good place to go through for loans?
Let's take a step back.
You can hear that LaVon's concerned, but he's trying not to sound discouraging. The student has made her decision. She's excited about going to college. That's a big deal. And LaVon doesn't want to make her feel bad about it. But he still worries. Is she going to get enough financial support to get not just to freshman year, but to graduation? Is she going to be able to pay back her debt?
I know that I'm going to need loans for most of the tuition, so.
LaVon and college counselors in cramped offices across the country have been tiptoeing through these conversations for weeks. That's because college decision deadlines are around the bend, and many students still haven't gotten their award letters. They've been held up by the now notorious FAFSA debacle. Federal officials tried to simplify the process of applying for financial aid and unleashed a whole host of delays and errors. Now, LaVon says students are tired of the application process, or they're feeling pressure from things like deadlines to secure student housing.
Are they going to wait to make it the best financial decision, or are they just going to choose early and choose colleges where they are going to have to take out more private loans?
Students normally get their award letters by February or March. That gives them a couple months to compare their options before college decision day, which is usually May 1st. But according to a recent survey, half of colleges hadn't even started sending award letters out. Some schools have pushed back their enrollment deadlines by a couple of weeks or a month. LaVon says that still doesn't leave students enough time to make informed decisions.
I think it really is going to fall on low-income students because, the wealthy students, they don't need the financial aid, though, so they're just going to make a decision.
That means the kids who are the most hurt by all this are the ones who have the least resources to pay for college. The very students the new FAFSA is supposed to help. It's one more message to low-income students that college is not for them. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
The errors and delays with the FAFSA process have left families frustrated. Peter Medlin continues our reporting.
By April 26th of last year, 2023, about 52% of DeKalb High School students had completed their FAFSA. By April 26th of this year, with the new FAFSA form, it's about half of that, down to 27%, according to the U.S. Department of Education. Shirley Rouse is a counselor at DeKalb High School who works with seniors, and she says that means fewer kids qualifying for federal student financial aid like the Pell Grant and eligible for state aid like the MAP Grant. Well, what happened? The delayed and botched rollout of the new FAFSA form. Rouse says that typically by May 1st, known as College Decision Day, 99% of her students know where they're going to school next year, but that's just not the case this year.
A lot of our students didn't know until mid-April, how much financial aid they were receiving. For students who had to make corrections, they couldn't do that till mid-April, so I still have students who don't have award letters from schools.
This is months behind the normal schedule where most students receive financial aid award letters in December or January. This year, students couldn't even try to submit their FAFSA until late December, but that's when the errors and glitches started. Now, obviously, this is not just a DeKalb problem. It's an issue students across the state and the country have encountered. There have been processing errors, technical glitches, and calculation mistakes. And Rouse says families who don't have Social Security numbers have had particular trouble.
This year they could create an account still, but there was major glitches with that, and that just got fixed this week where parents could go in. It was sending them to where they had to verify their identity and it wouldn't allow them to do that. So that's impacted quite a few students as well.
That means forms submitted in early January were in limbo for months before they could even try to correct them. 64% of DeKalb School District students are low income. Many might be first-generation college students who aren't used to filling out FAFSA or maneuvering the college admissions process. And DeKalb High School has hosted financial aid nights and FAFSA events since the fall, and they're still holding workshops during lunch to help students. It's been really frustrating for counselors like Rouse, and it hasn't even been easy to find which students need help.
I couldn't even access who completed the FAFSA until, you know, the middle of April. And last year we were able to do that in November, so you could connect with kids.
May 1st is known as College Decision Day because it's the admissions deadline at most schools, but because of all of these issues, many universities pushed back those deadlines. And with some of her students just receiving their financial aid award packages and others still in the dark, Rouse says they just have less time to make these big decisions about their future.
I can tell you in the last few weeks, I've had a lot of students come and like, I received my award letter. I'm thinking Kish might be a good option for me, or this was my number one school and I'm realizing it's not financially an option. So a lot of students are having to pivot and really late in the game.
She didn't expect this year to be such a mess. It's disheartening, but she still has faith that next year will be a lot better.
I think they predict 1.5 million students will qualify for the Pell Grant, more than in the past, the way the form was set up, so that's huge.
She's still seeing finished FAFSA forms roll in and says 30% of DeKalb students have completed it now, but the school year is ending soon. And Rouse is encouraging students to email her over the summer if they run into more issues or have questions, but says it's a lot easier to help families and students navigate this in person, so they'll keep up the lunchroom workshops until school lets out. I'm Peter Medlin.
We've got more to come on Statewide. We'll talk sports betting. That's on the way next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois has watched revenue from sports betting increase, and Governor J.B. Pritzker wants a bigger piece of the action. He wants to raise the state tax on sports betting operations from 15% to 35% starting in the new fiscal year. That's a big jump. To help us sort through the landscape, we have Chris Altruda, a senior analyst for Better Collective, which runs websites sportshandle.com and usbets.com.
Off the top, it becomes less revenue for them to take home. That's first and foremost. You're more than doubling your tax rate, and it's a substantial sum of money, especially when you look at the fact that FanDuel is the top operator in this state and generates high revenue totals month after month because they have the best, they have the best hold among mobile operators. So there's a lot at stake for every operator, regardless of what their market share is in this state. It's difficult. It's a difficult pill to swallow because 15% is really on the upper end of what I would call reasonable if you're not allowed to deduct promotional credits against your gross revenue as an operator. You can get away with 20%, but it's a lot tougher. 35% without promotional deductions. So you have three states only that have 20% or higher rates without promotional deductions if Illinois does go to 35%.
I'm sure somebody is going to say, well, people are going to gamble no matter what. There's going to be plenty of money out there. Would it impact the number of gamblers as well?
No, because it's a back-end tax. It's a tax only that the operator pays. People who make, I believe the threshold in Illinois is $800, get their own separate tax form, and they have to pay taxes on winnings, but it's not dependent on the operator they use, because you can acquire that $800 through any and all operators you choose to gamble with. So this is exclusively on the operator side and not the bettor side. Would it impact the amount wagered? Maybe, because an operator might be more hesitant to provide a higher volume of promotional offers to bettors. Illinois is a top three market when it comes to sports betting handle, and a clear cut number three, along with New York and New Jersey. It would be hard to see them falling off that third spot.
You used the term handle. I know not everybody is aware of that term. So maybe if you could define that for us. And then also when it comes to the state of Illinois, and we've seen projections out there, it's only been around legal here for a few years now. How is it doing overall? Is it meeting the expectations?
So a quick definition of handle is the amount people wager. If I was to place a $100 bet on, let's say, DePaul winning its next game, the $100 bet is the handle. In terms of how Illinois is performing, I could make a very easy case that I believe they're outperforming expectations because the percentage of revenue the operator keeps against the amount wagered is well above the industry standard of 7%. There's another argument to that, that 7% standard is obsolete because the evolution of sports betting has changed. Especially in Illinois, people are betting more on parlays, which lead to a higher hold for operators, which then leads to a higher revenue total for operators, which then leads to a higher tax revenue for the state.
When this first came in, I think there were people who were wondering, you know, what would this mean for casinos? And then, of course, we have video gambling and video gambling terminals, more of them in Springfield, where I'm located, than anywhere else in the state. Have we seen any type of evidence that's, and maybe here or other places, where sports betting sort of cannibalizes the rest of the gaming industry?
No. Sports betting is an add-on in its very general sense. There were concerns in the sausage-making process that FanDuel and DraftKings, and this goes back to as far back as 2014 to 2016 era, when Lisa Madigan was Attorney General and they had to provide a ruling on daily fantasy sports because there was a gray area. And during that time, FanDuel and DraftKings operated in the state without a definitive legal ruling. When it came down that daily fantasy sports were illegal, then you get to the sausage making process of sports wagering. What Neil Bloom, who was the chairman of Rush Street and a majority stakeholder in Rivers, wanted what was called a penalty box provision, in which an online only operator would have to wait 18 months until after the first casino had mobile wagering available. But what happened was, due to the pandemic, everything got thrown asunder. And what DraftKings and FanDuel both did was enter the state through existing casinos. And in the case of FanDuel, racetracks. FanDuel came in originally with Paradise Casino in Peoria, but their eventual goal was to always build a racino at Fairmount Park, which they has admittedly gone slower than expected. DraftKings in turn came in through Casino Queen in East St. Louis. And as long as you border states that don't have sports wagering yet, which is true in Illinois because you have Missouri to the west and Wisconsin to the north, you're not ever going to fully cannibalize casino revenue when it comes to sports betting, because you're going to have people coming in from out of states to bet retail. They're also going to eventually put the app on their phone, so when they cross state lines, then they'll do mobile betting. And because those mobile bets have to be placed in the state, you're still getting that tax revenue always flowing into the state. You can make an argument that maybe there's a little bit of cannibalization in terms of overall casino revenue, but that's a little harder to discern, especially also when you look at the fact that Illinois is doing what I call Casino 2.0 with this massive expansion that includes downtown Chicago, which includes Danville, which includes Waukegan, and all those places.
The Illinois is not necessarily done with expanding gambling. There's more pieces of legislation that are up for consideration right now. One of those has to do with legalizing casino internet gaming. You mentioned fantasy sports. Walk us through what those would do and how they might play into this idea of raising the sports betting tax.
Internet casino gaming tax would be an interesting legislative battle in Illinois, because it is the state that has the most extensive network of video gaming terminals in the country. And the amount of revenue that those machines generate, both in terms of state tax revenue, which I believe was north of $830 million last year, and even local revenue, which I believe is something to the effect of 140 million based on the, I believe it's a 6-to-1 split, but those machines are lifelines to local communities in terms of tax revenue. It extends further because most of them are at bars and taverns and VFWs. So you have the food and service industry, you have bars and taverns who are all backing this. It's not unreasonable for those bars, taverns, and service industries to believe that there would be some cannibalization on the VGT front because, one, it's on your phone, it's readily available, and there would be 3 online casino brands for every casino license. So you would have, arguably, as opposed to here, where you have 8 mobile sports betting options tethered to 8 casinos, those 8 casinos could conceivably have up to 24 internet casino gaming options. And that's a big difference.
Where does it all go from here? I mean, I'm in Springfield, and like I said, I'm seeing a lot of video gambling terminals. Those have been out there for quite a while. We're seeing this expansion among casinos. We've seen sports betting come on. Is there a saturation point, though, when it comes to the state and the revenue that can be received from this? Is there a point where we're getting to that saturation level?
I think the funny thing about Illinois is that there are still certain aspects where there's room for notable growth. Having only 8 mobile operators at this point, I believe a critical mass, I believe in most states is 11 or 12. You look at New York, which is the top marketplace in the country, it has 9. And then you look at a place like Ohio, which has, I believe, 20. And Ohio does roughly 70% of the handle that Illinois does, despite the populations being somewhat more comparable. You look at video gaming terminals, they're still not in Chicago. And there is a chance, because Mayor Johnson expressed some support of that during his campaigning, that they could come into Chicago. Now, I don't know how feasible that is when you have a casino building a venue in Chicago as well, but each aspect of gaming in this state still has a notable amount of runway left to go with.
Well, going back to the governor's tax proposal, raising the sports betting tax from 15% to 35%, not asking you to be a legislative expert on this, but do you think the governor can get this plan through the General Assembly?
In some respects, Governor Pritzker has the capital to do this because he is a key reason why mobile sports betting took off faster than expected in Illinois. Because there was an in-person registration provision in the law he signed, that would have gone a lot slower. But because of the pandemic, and also because DraftKings and FanDuel entered the state, there was no way to get people to casinos or to racetracks. And he suspended that in-person provision repeatedly during the pandemic. I believe when you count all of them, I believe it was either 10 or 11 times. These companies would not be as far along in terms of database signups, revenue, and even contributing tax revenue to the state had they had to sit the full 18 months and have people come to the casinos and register before having access to mobile betting. So I think at the end of the day, there'll be some pushback to it, but I also think he will get his way and get this right. I think one of the things that made the state think that they can do this is the fact that operators are winning so much more than expected. And a lot of that is because of the evolution in how people are betting. And in this state, it's one of the forerunners that parlay wagering has become a very big deal in terms of how a person bets. This year, roughly 29% of the handle, and it was $11.6 billion worth of wagers in the 2023 calendar year. About 29% of that was on parlay bets. So in some respects, it's understandable that the state wants a cut of that unexpected gain. People are essentially, what they're doing is essentially turning it into a lottery ticket in that you will construct a parlay, which to define it is you put multiple legs together and all of them have to win in order to collect. So for example, we'll go back to the DePaul game. If I bet on DePaul to win, and I also bet the under on that game and I put them together, both DePaul winning and the under have to hit in order for me to win that wager. And a very large portion of them are doing it with disposable income, whether it's a $1 bet, a $5 bet, or even a $10 bet. And until the mindset of the bettor changes that I lost $10, as opposed to what looks to be the current mindset of I came one win away from winning maybe $80, you're going to continue to see that operator revenue be at an increased level compared to what was originally planned.
Chris Altruda is a senior analyst for Bettor Collective, which runs websites sportshandle.com and usbets.com. Governor Pritzker has a plan to more than double the sports betting tax in Illinois. From casinos to video gambling machines to the sports betting apps on cell phones, it's easier to gamble now than perhaps ever before. And while that leads to increased tax revenue across Illinois, it's also accompanied by a growing problem, gambling addiction. Joe Deacon reports.
Bill Johnson of Bartonville is approaching 50 years in continuous recovery from various addictions.
When I got sober back in, we didn't even talk about gambling addiction back in the mid-70s, late 70s, it wasn't an issue. Would I have qualified? I'm not sure. I know the addictions I have are enough for me. I would not like to have more diagnoses, I don't think. But yeah, I gambled.
Johnson is the Director Emeritus of the Illinois Council on Problem Gambling, an organization he started overseeing in 2011. He says the proliferation of gambling opportunities is increasing the risk of exposure to potentially addictive behavior.
Where can you go that you don't see video gaming terminals? Well, I don't know. Every place I go, when I go out to eat, when I go to the gas station, there's a video gaming terminal. So more people are exposed to it, so more people are developing a problem. We've seen, historically, what we've seen is the big jump in problem gambling for sports gamers. They're young adult males, primarily between the ages of 21 and 35.
Johnson stresses the ICPG holds a neutral position on gambling, saying it's a legal form of entertainment in Illinois. The state is home to 16 casinos, including the Paradise Riverboat in East Peoria, as well as 13 licensed sports books and more than 8,500 licensed video gaming establishments. The industry generated $1.5 billion in tax revenue for the state and local communities in 2023. However, research by Health Resources in Action indicates 4% of Illinois residents have a gambling disorder and another 7% are at risk. That's more than a million people. Dr. Robert Leiser is the medical director of the Addiction Recovery Center at Peoria's Carle Health Proctor Hospital.
Many of these gamblers gamble to escape a lot of their true feelings and problems. They actually get euphoria from gambling, a pleasure sensation within the brain, so it makes them feel better. So just thinking about gambling or even on the way to gamble, many people have less anxiety, depression. And that's some of the concerns that I see.
Leiser says problem gambling can be just as debilitating as alcoholism or substance addiction.
People basically give up other forms of pleasure to go gamble, whether spending time with a family or even taking time for work when they should be doing these other things that are very critical to their life. They're spending it on focusing in the gambling cafes is what they're doing. And sometimes it can be as severe as even hygiene. Some people don't shower. Some people don't take care of themselves, eating. The gambling really takes over that pleasure center and drives it just like other substances.
With expanded access to gambling, the Illinois Department of Human Services reports that 68% of adults in the state participated in some form of gambling in the past year. Johnson says it's getting harder and harder to avoid some exposure to the various ways to place bets.
How can you not? I mean, I just was reaching for my phone. I mean, you got it all right now that you can sit on your couch now and make a bet on anything. Any sports action I watch around the edge of the screen of the baseball game or the UFC fights, there's little odds about somebody saying, hey, you know, I'll give you $1,500 free if you bet on this fight. So you can't get away from it.
Leiser points out that activities such as investing in the stock market or playing video games with in-game purchases also can develop into gambling addictions. He says treatment options can range from medication to psychotherapy and counseling.
We do have Gambling Anonymous, which is a 12-step program which we can use also. So there's a lot of other peer-supported activities that can be used to help treating it. But the treatment needs to be derived from someone who's certified in a gambling addiction.
People can seek out help with problem gambling by calling 1-800-GAMBLER, texting GAMB to 833-234, or visiting areyoureallywinning.com. I'm Joe Deacon.
Thanks for tuning in to Statewide. We'll be back with more right after this. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll talk about the slow cleanup for coal ash pollution in Illinois. But first, sheep producers in the Midwest say wool prices have been dismal for decades, but in recent years they've fallen to new lows, and that's left producers sometimes dumping wool rather than selling it for just cents on the dollar. And as Rachel Kramer with Harvest Public Media reports, now some producers are pivoting.
It's early spring, and sheep shearers have come to the Corey family farm. With smooth, clean strokes, a shearer cuts through several inches of wool on a ewe. In just minutes, a fleece drops to the floor, and the ewe returns to the flock with her new buzz cut. On this day, more than 100 sheep at this central Iowa farm were sheared, each losing about 8 pounds of wool. But it won't bring in much money.
We'll get just a few cents a pound, really.
That's Mary Corey, regardless of what they get paid for the wool. She says shearing is essential for the sheep's health and for lambs to more easily nurse in the spring. Tom Corey, who started raising sheep in the early 1960s, remembers when wool was an asset.
I was able to get enough money from that wool that I could pay for their winter feed. Today, I can't even pay for half the shearing.
The Coreys, like most producers in the Midwest, raise sheep primarily for meat, not the wool. But as wool prices have dropped, the costs of shearing and transporting the wool are biting into producers' profits. Jalen Whaley is a sheep field specialist with South Dakota State University Extension.
We're in a really, I think, volatile place right now, we feel like, because our numbers are dropping and we're having a hard time keeping people in the industry.
She says the drop in wool prices is connected with global forces far from farms in middle America. Demand from China, the largest importer of American wool, fell sharply in 2019 in the midst of a trade war with the U.S. Then COVID hit, shutting down wool processors and disrupting supply chains. But sheep kept growing wool, leading to a global oversupply and even lower prices. Whaley says there are options for sheep producers.
We just have to be willing to get innovative and make those changes that are profitable.
That includes finding new uses for wool. Wendy Johnson runs Counting Sheep Sleep Company from her northern Iowa farm. She shows off a creamy white and lightly speckled batting that comes from her sheep.
This is what fills the pillows. And it's just such a nice fiber.
Johnson sends her wool to a mill in Minnesota where it's cleaned and turned into this batting to fill pillows, comforters, eye masks that she then sells.
Here we raise this incredible animal on grass and sunshine and rain and soil alone. And they just keep growing this completely renewable fiber that has all these attributes.
Wool is thermoregulating, meaning it can keep people comfortable in hot and cold conditions. It's also biodegradable and can act as a natural fertilizer. In south central Nebraska, Megan Landis Murphy turns coarse wool from her sheep and other producers into pellets for the garden.
I think wool pellets are a great outlet for this underutilized wool. And then it's also beneficial for plant enthusiasts and gardeners alike.
The pellets add nitrogen to the soil and can absorb and release excess moisture. Landis Murphy says she's glad to help producers find a new use for their wool through her Kestrel Ridge Pellet Company.
I think it's really exciting for sheep producers because I've heard of them just like burying or burning their wool just to get rid of it because they feel like that's the only option they have.
But some producers are moving toward a sheep that doesn't produce much wool. Called hair sheep, they naturally shed in the spring, so no shearing is needed. Back on Tom and Mary Corey's farm, they've bought a small flock for one of their sons to raise.
To incorporate a hair breed of sheep that would not require the shearing, and there are also other potential benefits of just being a hardier type sheep.
But Ron Kilstrom, one of their shearers and a sheep producer himself, isn't so sure about wool-less sheep.
It disturbs me a little bit. Sheep should have wool on them, period.
After all, shearing sheep is his business. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Ticks are pretty small, but the diseases they spread can pack a wallop. Rich Egger talked with a researcher who says ticks are not only spreading, but are now more active for more months of the year than in the past.
Brian Allen has been researching ticks for about 24 years. It started when he was a college student. He had a summer internship working on the ecology of Lyme disease in upstate New York. Allen found it interesting to be out catching ticks and testing them for the Lyme pathogen.
And what really struck a chord with me is I was working on private property. So I was going up to people's doors, knocking on their door, asking them if I could collect ticks on their land. Once they got over their initial shock of sort of, you know, what I was doing there, everybody I spoke to in that part of the country had a personal experience with Lyme disease. They'd had it themselves, a family member had had it, and I came to realize that people were really personally affected by that disease, and it really motivated me. It made me realize I could do something with my biology training that would be helpful to people.
And I have to ask you, when you're out catching ticks, do they ever catch you?
All the time. I've been bitten more times than I can count by ticks in my life.
Is this, I guess, part of the process? You have to check your body when you're done in the field every day?
That's right, yeah. And I really impress that upon my students. It's well documented that that's one of the most effective ways to prevent tick-borne disease. Most pathogens transmitted by ticks are not instantly transmitted. It takes a while for the tick to bite you and for the pathogen to go from the tick to the human. And so if you're working in places where there are ticks, if you check yourself a couple times a day, and I mean really check yourself, you can find those ticks and remove them before they infect you. And so once I've gotten good at that, I've gotten really good at preventing myself from being exposed to tick-borne diseases.
Is that advice you give to people working in the yard, for example? Do they need to check themselves every time they come in?
100%. If you're living or working in an area where ticks are common and you're concerned about tick-borne disease, there's a couple things you can do to protect yourself. Some repellents are more effective against ticks than others, especially repellents with permethrin are good at repelling ticks. Physical barriers are really helpful, too. So tuck your pants into your socks, tuck your shirt into your pants. That creates a physical barrier between you and the tick, and it makes it easier for you to notice the tick when they get on you. And then finally, at the end of the day of gardening, before you take a shower, really give yourself a thorough check for ticks. And if you find them, use the appropriate methods to remove them. And if you do those things in combination, you have a pretty good shot at preventing an illness.
You mentioned repellents. Are there any natural flowers or plants that you can put in a yard that might cause ticks to go elsewhere?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, that's an active area of inquiry, more in terms of trying to find things that we can extract from plants that we can use to make new repellents. There's actually a new repellent in the pipeline that comes from grapefruit. And it's going to be synthesized, so it won't be the compound. It's not like you're going to squeeze a grapefruit on yourself. But it's supposed to be a very effective repellent. So in laboratory studies, it's really good at repelling ticks and mosquitoes. And so once that hits the market, that's going to be my go-to repellent for preventing tick bites. In terms of landscaping, I haven't seen anything that's convinced me that there's certain plants you can plant in your garden that would, you know, keep ticks out of your yard. So I don't personally have any opinion on that, but a lot of our repellents, a lot of our medicines are come from nature and particularly from plants.
Let's go back to your early time in upstate New York.
Sure. What,
you said just about everyone you talked to had some sort of story. Can you give us an idea of what you were hearing from people?
Yeah, absolutely. So Lyme disease is a tough disease to deal with for a couple of reasons. One is it's hard to diagnose. The symptoms can be kind of nonspecific. So people get flu-like symptoms in the summertime. Many people associate a bullseye rash with Lyme disease, and it's true. Some people who get Lyme disease get a bullseye rash, but you don't always. And so it's hard to diagnose, and if people get sick and they don't treat it right away, it can form into a chronic illness. And that chronic illness is much harder to treat. And so a lot of the people I spoke to in New York, which has a very high prevalence of Lyme disease, had horror stories about having developed the chronic illness or having a loved one who developed the chronic illness. And last I checked, about 20% of the people who develop chronic Lyme disease, they never are cured of it. And so it becomes a debilitating lifelong condition where it affects their health, it affects their mental state, it can affect their ability to work, And so the economic losses from Lyme disease are considerable because you can take people who are otherwise healthy and productive, and they lose that as a result of having developed chronic Lyme disease.
Brian Allen is a professor of entomology at the University of Illinois Champaign and does research on vector-borne diseases. Allen says there are now at least three tick species in Illinois that pose major health risks. He says they're spreading in part due to climate change and partly due to wildlife, especially white-tailed deer, as their populations increase in many states. He does not want to scare people away from enjoying the mental and physical benefits of spending time outdoors. He says just take the proper precautions. Allen was in Macomb to speak at Western Illinois University. Rich Egger reporting.
Illinois lawmakers passed landmark regulations 5 years ago to clean up the state's coal ash pollution, but years later, advocates are still waiting for the first cleanup permits to be issued. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco has the story.
There's this memory burned into the back of Dulce Ortiz's mind. She was giving a presentation a decade ago at her son's middle school in Waukegan about pollution. She asked the class,
do you know anybody or like a family or friend or yourself that has asthma?
It was supposed to be a softball kind of question, but it didn't play out that way.
And I would vouch to say that 90% of the kids raised their hands, and that was really, you know, I cried. I did when I saw that. Still to this day, it hurts.
The reason? Ortiz points to the Waukegan Generating Station. It's a coal plant near the shores of Lake Michigan that pumped pollution into the air and coal ash into the ground in Waukegan for about a century. It closed in 2022. Ortiz is a 30-year resident of Waukegan. She's a co-founder of Clean Power Lake County, an environmental justice group that organized for years to shut down the Waukegan coal plant. But that was just the first part of the fight.
Because there's two coal ash pits, and there is a coal ash legacy landfill.
Coal ash is the hazardous cocktail of pollutants left over from coal combustion, and it's stored in holes in the ground, sometimes lined and sometimes not. In Waukegan, they aren't lined, according to state and federal regulations. Then, in 2019, the state confirmed what Ortiz and others had long suspected, that coal ash from the Waukegan plant had leached into nearby groundwater. Worse yet, the coal ash was stored right near the lake.
For me, as a resident, right, that is the source of our drinking water. And so what I call it is a ticking time bomb.
As the country moves away from coal, there's still an open question about what to do with all the coal ash that's accumulated in the ground. In Illinois, this is especially important because the state has the second most coal ash impoundments of any in the country, just barely trailing Indiana.
So we've had these rules in place for 3 years. And shortly after that, industry was required to submit permit proposals for all these.
That's Andrew Rain. He's the director of climate policy at the Prairie Rivers Network based in Champaign. He says that Illinois passed some of the most comprehensive regulations for coal ash in the country. But 5 years later, the implementation of those guidelines is lagging.
These are high priority sites. They're near population centers, they're near environmental justice communities, or they're near precious, you know, water resources that we're looking to protect. You got to move forward on these sooner rather than later.
The Illinois EPA is currently reviewing 44 coal ash permit applications for over two dozen sites across the state. So far, there are only two draft permits. In a statement to WBEZ, the agency said the delay is due to the complexity of the information required. But Ortiz says the longer the north suburb has to wait for permits, the more the coal ash can continue to seep into the groundwater, potentially endangering drinking water for everyone, especially as climate change accelerates erosion on the lakeshore.
If we have a really bad weather event on the lake, like, you don't know if that technology that they're using to gap it in place is going to be safe and secure.
Ortiz doesn't swim in Lake Michigan. She won't let her kids near it either. The coal ash pollution makes it too risky, she says. But eventually, she'd like to take a dip in the lake again someday. But at the pace the state is going, it could be a while. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco, WBEZ News.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week, but we'll return next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.